Hello, I'm Manuela Zaragoza. Welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. Coming up, is there life for Apple beyond the iPhone?
People are looking at that device, particularly as they become more expensive, and saying, you know what, I'm going to keep that one more year, a couple more years longer, because it does everything I need.
iPhone sales have fallen, but just how vulnerable are the likes of Apple and other big tech giants to new entrants in their markets?
These companies create so-called dead zones around their dominant platforms where investors and really firms are reluctant to enter and grow because of their power.
That's all here in Business Daily from the BBC. People just aren't buying as many iPhones as they used to. That was clear when Apple reported earlier this week that sales of its flagship product fell. The company blamed its slow sales on China, the world's biggest smartphone market. But many analysts say there's a broader problem. The smartphone has now been around for a decade, and last year, for the first time, smartphone sales overall fell around the world for all brands, not just the iPhone. So if the world has indeed hit peak a smartphone, as it's called, what comes after? My colleague Ed Butler spoke to Ben Wood, senior analyst at the market research firm CCS Insight.
If you think back a decade ago, where we had this eclectic mix of mobile phones, all different shapes and sizes, flip phones, folding phones, candy bars, every iteration of the technology got better. The screen got bigger, higher resolution, better camera, more capabilities like maps and things like music players. There was a really good reason to upgrade your phone. Now, with the ubiquitous kind of sea of sameness that has become the smartphone, people are looking at that device, particularly as they've become more expensive, and saying, you know what, I'm going to keep that one more year, a couple more years longer, because it does everything I need. And we have come to a kind of common design language, as you see in other products, you know, TVs, vehicles, domestic appliances. A lot of them center on a form factor that just works. And I think we have to give credit to Apple and Steve Jobs. And when he walked on the stage in January 2007 and pulled the iPhone out of his pocket, he kind of delivered the dominant design, which is now the one that's firmly established.
Yeah, and they're all good, but the big question is, would you spend $1,000 on that?
So it's very interesting that you raise the $1,000 price point, because actually that's a relatively new milestone for the industry. A few years ago, a flagship phone cost around $600. Now Apple has pushed that because they believe there's an inherent value in the device, and they push that forward. And I think that high level of price really has meant that people look at that device and say, if I've spent that much money, I want to get a lot of value from that product. I bought one which has a great amount of memory. It has software that can be upgraded. The camera's good enough. You know what? That'll do for now.
Looking at Apple specifically, they've issued warnings to investors to some extent about kind of declining sales. How much of a threat is this to this great titan of tech itself, do you think?
This could be more of a temporary dip in the Apple momentum because of the fact that they've reached a point of critical mass where people have stopped renewing. But I always think of the iPhone as somewhat the Hotel California of smartphones. Once you're in, it's very, very difficult to leave. So people might not buy a new one this year, but when they need another phone, it's highly probable they'll go and see Apple. One other observation on Apple, though, is make no mistake, they are investing very, very heavily in numerous areas. They're notoriously secretive about what they're doing, but it is widely viewed that they are working extensively on autonomous vehicle and automotive technology, on smart glasses, which I think is an interesting area. And of course, they continue to invest in things like wearable tech as well, the Apple Watch being a good example of that.
What are the innovations now that are being pushed by the phone makers?
Well, the technology that everybody is watching with a great interest right now is the ability to use flexible displays and therefore have devices that can fold and screens that can fold.
I've got a picture of one in front of me. it does look a bit funny and great, I suppose. Like, I could fold a piece of paper, I could fold a phone and put it in my pocket. Why would I want to do that?
Well, therein lies the big question that is unanswered. This right now looks like a solution looking for a problem. The gadget lovers will find it a magnet in terms of the latest and greatest. But I think most consumers will look at it right now and go, it's very, very expensive. It's a kind of early stage product. I think we're kind of in the stone age of the flexible device. But I want to make it very clear, I do believe that we are at the beginning of the next generation of what we'll get to. It's just it's not cooked yet.
Throw it further ahead. I mean, dream for me a moment, you know. What are we going to have? Phones. Obviously, we have Apple have the Apple Watch, the wearable, which, of course, is duplicated by other companies. And that idea, well, I don't know, it's got limited value. It's small. You can't perhaps use it quite the way you would a phone. You never will. Maybe you're going to have it built into your hand. I mean, dream for me a second.
So from my perspective, one of the most exciting areas right now is the way in which we are interacting with devices and machines and services through voice. And it's a bit ironic, really, because voice has become a bit old-fashioned on phones. Everyone's looking at their phones. We had this transition from a voice to a visual interaction with a device. People started with texting, then they were surfing the web. Now they're watching video. Voice has become fashionable again through these assistants, smart assistants that we can have. And therefore, that starts to mean that you'll use your device differently. And maybe you don't necessarily need all of that real estate. If we really throw it forward, I can envision a point where perhaps you don't need such a big phone because you'll have screens all around you that you can seamlessly link to. That could be a wall in your home, or it could be the screen in front of you, or wherever you happen to be. Every surface will be a screen. The watch, potentially, which you alluded to, could become the hub in terms of the connectivity. And I think that's one of the reasons why Apple is pushing so hard there. You will have headphones, which could be built into a pair of glasses through conductive technology, so you can actually hear the sound. And of course, glasses become the screen for you as well. So actually, you have this body-worn technology, which allows you to communicate, and you don't necessarily have to be handcuffed to the device that's in your hand. You can interact in a very different, more fluid way.
That was Ben Wood, senior analyst at CCS Insight, speaking there to my colleague Ed Butler. The fall in smartphone sales affects Apple more than other companies because so much of the money Apple makes comes from selling its iPhone. That makes Apple different from rivals Huawei and Samsung, which do sell other stuff. But our North America tech reporter Dave Lee has been combing through Apple's recent accounts from this week and noticed something new.
Apple has always been very much a hardware company, doing that very, very well, and selling services, Apple Pay, Apple Music, various different things that Apple now offers through its products on the strength of those device sales. We are seeing a bit of shift, which is an interesting one, because Apple, of course, has been notorious for not playing nice with other companies' products and not allowing their software on, say, on Windows PCs and so forth. But recently, we've seen Apple reach out to companies like Samsung and suggested that Samsung could serve Apple content through Samsung televisions for the first time. And I think we're going to see more of those kind of deals in the future as Apple kind of pivots, as they say, in Silicon Valley, away from making its hardware the be-all and end-all and saying, you know what, maybe we should be offering our content across wherever we can put it, and that's how we're going to make up these numbers. One of the other aspects of this is that Apple is still sitting on an enormous amount of cash, $245 billion in cash, that if it wanted to, it could certainly go on a huge shopping spree and add to that services portfolio, bring more things into the company that could boost that services number even further. So, as I say, they're kind of transitioning to a new type of Apple, one that isn't so reliant on the hardware it sells.
The BBC's North America technology reporter there, Dave Lee. Will all that be enough to ensure Apple has a life beyond the iPhone? It seems hard to imagine a world without Apple and the iPhone. The brand and its products, like Amazon and Google, are firmly ingrained in modern life. But history teaches us that brands do come and go. Remember Napster? Or how about Blockbuster, Concord, TWA, BlackBerry, Nokia? All brands and companies that are no longer with us or have slipped into obscurity. Yves Doz is Emeritus Professor of Strategic Management at INSEAD in Paris. He's also the co-author of Ringtone, Exploring the Rise and Fall of Nokia in Mobile Phones. I asked him what it takes for big companies to survive disruption.
I think you need three ingredients. You need one ingredient, which is, you know, do I understand what's going on in the world around me with some amount of foresight? Or am I just reacting to changes when they hit me? If you're not aware of something, you're not going to change as a function of this.
So it's kind of
goes fast.
Being ahead of the pack and the game all the time.
Yeah, and some form of intellectual leadership or intellectual understanding of how the world is changing around you and what does that mean for the future. Level two is an ability to reallocate resources and have resources that are capable of being redeployed toward new purposes.
So a nimble company, a nimble company.
Yeah, and internally not to be paralyzed. You see, part of what many companies suffer from without knowing it is the people, like when we age, you know, our arteries become less flexible and more rigid and more, and therefore we are prone to having various kind of cardiac problems and so on. Companies are a bit the same. You know, there is this kind of hardening of the organization, hardening of the structure, and many companies which fall victims of disruption is they have had a relatively quiet life for a long time, and therefore they have lost this capability to be fluid and flexible. And then the third thing for me is you need a team at the top. If you have a band of rivals who fight each other for executive succession, for resource allocation, for different business opportunities, then typically the company tends to fall apart.
But is Nokia an example of a company that you think has got it right?
They got it right in the early years. Go back to the 1990s, they were remarkably successful. But then they lost it. And they fell apart not because of Apple or Google. Apple and Google came later on and they basically blew on a house of cards. But Nokia had become a house of cards because of internal dysfunctions.
So what lessons do you think Nokia has for Apple then?
Where they are obviously facing challenge is they are victim of their own success to some extent, which is they became so dependent on high-priced iPhone products that the transition toward platforms, content distribution, despite the success of iTunes and other things, is dwarfed for the time being by the success of the iPhone. If iPhone sales slow down, there is a need to worry about what is the next big thing. So there is more a strategic problem of what next, rather than an organizational problem of not working effectively internally.
That was Professor Yves Dos, Emeritus Professor of Strategic Management at INSEAD in Paris. Should we care if iconic companies like Apple shrink or fail? Apple is part of a new era of tech companies that take dominant positions in their markets. Companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook. Some call them monopolies. Sandeep Vaisan is the legal director at the Open Markets Institute in Washington, D.C. That's an anti-monopolies advocacy group. I started by asking him if monopoly was the correct way to describe these dominant tech firms.
Absolutely. If you look at their core markets, in the case of Facebook social media, in the case of Google search, in e-commerce, Amazon, they have overwhelming control of these markets, upwards of 70-80% market share, and their rivals are insignificant, if not marginal. So I think monopoly is the absolutely correct description for these giants.
So would you look at Apple as a monopoly as well then?
Apple is a somewhat different creature. So in the United States, at least, Android is effectively a co-equal in the mobile phone market with Apple. And looking outside of the United States, Android actually has much larger market shares. But then zooming in on Apple's platform itself, Apple does engage in practices to ensure that it's a closed system and that no competitive threats emerge to it on its own platform. So for instance, if you're an iPhone user and want to purchase an app, you have to go through the Apple App Store. You cannot purchase apps directly from app developers or through alternative retail channels. So looking just at its own platform, Apple is engaging in practices that limit competition and force iPhone users to conduct business exclusively with Apple or Apple-controlled channels.
But then they created these markets. I mean, smartphones were invented by Apple, so it couldn't have been otherwise, could it?
So even taking their claims of extraordinary innovation as true, that doesn't give them license to monopolize markets and exclude competitors. So I think it's important to distinguish between their technological contributions and their business practices.
So what impact does that have on innovation generally? Say we come into a situation where smartphone sales do taper off quite significantly, as we saw starting last year. Apple can't make any headway anymore with its iPhone sales. It loses that kind of edge that it has at the moment. Does it matter? Does that mean it's easier for other players to come into the market?
I think their size has unavoidable effects on innovation. So to make it a little bit more concrete, if I want to start a website to offer some product or service to the public, typically I will rely heavily on Google to gain followers and build market share. Given how much power Google has over what we see on the internet, a startup like that faces significant challenges in attracting funding. I think venture capitalists and other financiers are likely to ask, well, you have a great idea, but if Google can marginalize and really disappear you overnight, I'm afraid that your business model is not one I want to invest in. So I think there is a real effect on innovation because these companies create effectively so-called dead zones around their dominant platforms where investors and really firms are reluctant to enter and grow because of their power. They're very secure and they can identify emerging competition and either nip those threats in the bud or simply buy them out.
But what about companies like Facebook? I mean, we can say they are a big company, they're monopolistic, but there is no other equivalent to Facebook.
That's true. A social media platform is more valuable to users the larger it gets. No one wants to be on a social media platform with only 5 or 10 other people. But I think looking back a couple of years, we saw rising competition coming from sources like Instagram and WhatsApp. And these platforms have the real potential of becoming direct competitors to Facebook. Unfortunately, our Federal Trade Commission here in the United States didn't recognize the competitive threat that these companies pose to Facebook, and so allowed Facebook to buy out two of its most promising rivals.
So you're saying that was a big mistake?
It was a huge mistake. And I think people are increasingly recognizing that those are two key missteps from American regulators in dealing with the tech sector. I think the European Commission is certainly closer to getting it right than its American counterparts. For example, it imposed a significant fine on Google last summer for engaging in activity that cemented its dominance in mobile search. But I think even in Europe, the authorities are not going nearly far enough. They're taking the approach that if we repeatedly fine these companies, that will deter them from engaging in bad activity. But I think they really need to take the next step and start seriously thinking about addressing their power directly and breaking them up.
So that's what you think the solution should be, just break these companies up.
I think that's an important part of the solution.
Sandeep Vahisan of Open Markets there. He brings us to the end of this edition of Business Daily. For more analysis of Apple's earnings from this week, head to the BBC website. Business Daily is back again at the same time on Monday.
A brand new podcast drama from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the 1979 Iranian Revolution.
I ask you to down tools in your workplace.
I must rule, not reign this nation.
Refuse your job.
You've noticed the screaming.
Cease your studies.
We will plant flowers in their gun barrels.
Close your store.
They say the city's on fire. We get to put it out.
Disobey every day and every night.
Total control of the state, even of the souls of his people.
Rise and sacrifice your blood.
What if we kill them, sir?
Open fire!
Fall of the Shah. Find it wherever you found this podcast.